It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine joins us to break down some top science news, including what scientists are learning from nothingness in space and what scientifically defines a creep.
First, the presidential race took yet another turn on Sunday. In a letter to Congress, FBI Director James Comey announced that the Bureau would stand by its earlier decision, which was not to seek charges against Hillary Clinton for using a private email server as Secretary of State.
The announcement concluded a second FBI probe after emails connected to Clinton were discovered on the computer of former Congressman Anthony Weiner, who is also the estranged husband of Clinton's aide, Huma Abedin.
Rosalind Helderman joins us now. She's a political reporter for The Washington Post. She's been following the investigations into Hillary Clinton's emails. Rosalind, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what was the reasoning given by the FBI Director James Comey for these emails, I guess, not being a problem after all?
Yeah, in his letter, like his initial letter 9 days ago, he didn't give a lot of details. He just said that the FBI had reviewed all of the emails that were sent to or from Hillary Clinton that they had found in this unrelated investigation that we know is the Anthony Weiner matter, and they had found nothing to cause them to change the conclusions that he had reached in July. We do have some additional reporting outside of the letter. According to our sources, the FBI found that the majority of the material that they reviewed were either duplicates of emails that they had reviewed earlier in the investigation or were purely personal. They had nothing to do with State Department business.
Let's look at the reaction from the two campaigns. What, first of all, have we heard from the Hillary Clinton camp on this?
I don't believe, unless I'm mistaken, I don't believe Hillary Clinton herself has addressed the matter. A variety of her campaign aides have, however, and they have indicated just that they were always confident the FBI would find nothing and that they're pleased that that was, in fact, the case and that they said so publicly, but they are not backing off criticism of the way that James Comey has handled this last little piece of the campaign.
And then Donald Trump has been making a lot of this since the initial letter to Congress about these letters on Anthony Weiner's computer. Here's a part of his response at a rally in Michigan yesterday.
Right now, she is being protected by a rigged system. It's a totally rigged system. I've been saying it for a long time. You can't review 650,000 new emails in 8 days. You can't do it, folks. Hillary Clinton is guilty. She knows it. The FBI knows it. The people know it. And now it's up to the American people to deliver justice at the ballot box on November 8th.
And Rosalind, these emails had been referenced in Donald Trump's TV ads over the last few days, not letting go of this issue despite this announcement from James Comey.
Yeah, I would just note that the clip that you just played was sort of based on a factual inaccuracy. No one ever reported that there were 650,000 Hillary Clinton emails on the laptop. That is a number that has been cited by sources of the number of total emails that were found on the laptop. The vast majority of them, we understand, are Anthony Weiner emails, nothing to do with Hillary. And then we do think that there were probably tens of thousands, but there are sophisticated computer programs you can use to sift out all the ones that were duplicates. It's certainly possible that the FBI would be able to review the emails in this amount of time, working around the clock, which they said they did.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of the FBI and the position that James Comey was in through this. It looks like he was going to be doomed to be criticized no matter what he did. If he, in that first letter, he was criticized for sending it to Congress, making this an issue. But if he hadn't, he risked being criticized for covering up an issue. What kind of position was he in here?
We understand that he felt very conflicted and torn. It is officially Department of Justice policy that they are not supposed to take public investigative steps in the weeks just before an election on a matter that won't be able to be resolved before the election that might cause the public to conclude that they are trying to influence an election, even if that is not, in fact, their goal. There's a concern that you don't want a perception is an issue for the FBI. You don't want to look like you might be trying to influence the election. So he was actually warned by his bosses at the Department of Justice that this letter would violate that policy. But our understanding is that he felt like for trust in the agency, the alternative would be worse, the alternative in which he said nothing and it leaked out that they were looking at this and it looked like he was trying to cover it up.
when it comes to trust in the agency. Now it seems like everybody's angry with him, Democrats, for that initial letter, Donald Trump at least, and his supporters for what he has just announced now, kind of saying, no, no problem here. So what does trust in the FBI look like at this point?
Yeah, it's a really troubling issue. And don't forget, this also dates back to what he decided to do in July, which also pleased no one, right? Recommending no charges, which, of course, very much angered the right, but then giving this long press conference and testifying before Congress about all the ways in which she had done things that were wrong but not illegal, which did not please the left. That's not generally the role of the FBI. So there's some significant work to be done to restore the agency's reputation, no matter who wins tomorrow.
We're talking to Rosalind Helderman from the Washington Post about the latest Hillary Clinton email related news. Rosalind, you at the Washington Post have been reporting on the FBI's involvement in the race more widely, including, it looks like, disputes within the FBI over how and whether to investigate the Clinton Foundation. What do we know about what happened there and where that stands?
Yeah, we do know that there was an investigation, or maybe a better way to put it, a preliminary inquiry that was opened out of the New York field office of the FBI. Some agents in that office felt like they were developing good information, but there was a split between the FBI and the Department of Justice, but also between the field guys in New York and FBI leadership in Washington over the strength of that investigation. We understand that the prosecutors and the career people in DOJ felt like there was not much to that investigation and did not want to move ahead, while the field agents believed that they had developed enough information to do things like issue some subpoenas and start doing interviews. And they were told not to do that, which is not unusual. This happens in the law enforcement community, that investigators want to push harder than prosecutors, but they were told not to proceed. But then you have a situation where you have folks who are disgruntled, and apparently it looks now like started to leak information, which is not a good situation.
And there have been calls, depending on who you listen to, some people calling for Comey to resign or to be replaced under potentially a President Clinton. I've seen some Republicans who are against Trump making that same call, that it's time for him to go. You quoted somebody in one of your stories saying it's time to get the FBI's house in order, whoever does that. What would need to happen at the FBI to solve some of these criticisms?
Well, specifically as it relates to Comey, FBI directors serve 10-year terms. It's intended to cross presidencies. He's in only the third year of his 10-year term. That said, they officially serve at the pleasure of the president, so whoever is elected on Tuesday could fire him if they chose to do so. That is extremely rare in this country. Presidents don't want to do that out of respect for the independence of the office. So I would not necessarily expect to see a President Clinton fire Jim Comey. I suppose he could offer to resign as a way of trying to heal some wounds, or he could stay on and work on it and work on system and try to restore faith within his agency and in the public.
And a lot of people have been trying to gauge how much impact these back-to-back letters to Congress over the emails have had on the election, on polling. Do you have any sense from where you're reporting on whether these were a big deal when it comes to how people are going to vote tomorrow?
I mean, it appears that they did contribute to a tightening of the polls, particularly in the days just after the letter, but perhaps the polls sort of bounced back even before Comey's letter yesterday, sometime last week. At the end of the day, no need to try to read any crystal balls anymore. We'll learn tomorrow.
Are you expecting any? I mean, we've had big bombshells a week out from elections, effectively a couple days out. Are you expecting anything between now and tomorrow morning?
Well, it's been quiet so far today, so, you know, fingers crossed. I mean, I certainly think that one thing we're watching for is there have been these warnings of possible cyber hacks or other attempts to sow sort of confusion and problems in the election. So we'll, you know, we have our eye out for that, but hopefully we're just going to proceed to a vote, and the suspense will all just come from the voters.
Rosalind, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Rosalind Helderman. She's a political reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us to talk about reactions to a second FBI probe into Hillary Clinton's emails, which cleared her of criminal wrongdoing just days before the election.
Coming up, we'll talk about nothing with Gemma Tarlack of Discover Magazine. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out what music to listen to if we're looking to reduce our pre-election anxiety.
Right now, it's pretty commonly known that space has a lot of empty space in it. But scientists now know that these areas of nothingness, known as cosmic voids, can teach us a lot about our universe.
Gemma Tarlak is with us to break this down and other top science news with us. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. And she joins us every month to share some of the latest science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
Not bad, considering it's the day before election, a lot going on. So we get to talk about science instead as a palate cleanser. So, Gemma, it doesn't seem like it's counterintuitive that there's a lot of nothing in space, but I guess we can learn a lot of stuff from that nothingness.
Yeah, and actually, you know, 60% of the universe that we figured out so far is in these cosmic voids area. And I think kind of the easiest way to imagine it is, you know, those nighttime, maps of like the United States or even the world where you see cities, these huge big clumps of light, and they're kind of connected by interstates and other highways. And in the middle of all that light, there are these huge pockets where it's just emptiness. Those are, you know, cosmic voids if you want to translate cities into galaxies. So like the cities clump together, just like galaxies clump together, and then they leave all this open space, this open hinterland, so to speak, of the universe. And those are cosmic voids. And actually, it turns out there's a lot going on in those spaces that can teach us not only about things like dark energy and dark matter, but even how the universe formed and is evolving.
I wonder, if I were an astronomer, and I'm not, but I would think, oh, look, there's a star that blew up. Here's this nebula that's producing new stars. Here are these weird things and galaxies. My eye might be drawn toward that and away from all this nothing. Have astronomers spent a lot of time historically studying the void?
Actually, this whole field of study is pretty new. It was only in the 70s, actually, that they started realizing, hey, you know, galaxies are not distributed evenly across the universe. They're clumping together. What's up with that? And as they started to look more closely, and as technology advanced, where, you know, it's kind of hard to see in the dark. So when you're looking at these dark cosmic voids, it takes a lot of technology to see what's going on in there. But as technology advanced and they were able to see, they started to realize that there are definitely things going on. There are galaxies kind of sprinkled very, very rarely within these voids. And these galaxies in and of themselves are special because they're evolving differently than the galaxies that are kind of clumped up with other galaxies.
Wow. Do we know what's different about them?
We're figuring it out. You know, this is, again, a fairly new field of study, and it's really only really taken off, I would say, maybe in the last 10 years as technology has enabled astronomers to really see into these areas. And it looks like, you know, the galaxies are kind of going their own way, if you want to look at it like that. And in the clumps of galaxies, like where our own Milky Way sits, there are a lot of galaxy mergers. You know, they're slamming into each other. They're getting sucked into these areas of great attraction where they kind of bunch up even more tightly clustered. But these other galaxies in the cosmic void, they're not under those pressures. They're not colliding with any other galaxy because there's nothing around for them. So they're really going their own way. And we're just starting to learn what that means.
So you mentioned that the cosmic voids, these areas of not a galaxy, could tell us something about how the universe formed. What kind of things are we hoping to learn there?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different theories. And part of it is that there may actually be a fifth force at work, something that, you know, gravity does not apply here. That's one theory. There's another theory that, well, Einstein hit the nail on the head for most stuff, but maybe in this one particular area, his theories aren't quite right, and we need to modify them for these areas. So understanding how these areas work, because they're, I should say, these voids are changing all the time, and generally they're getting bigger and bigger and pushing the galaxies that are already clumped together, pushing them together even more. So there's a lot going on, and we're just starting to understand exactly what it is and why it's happening.
Could this answer some of the questions that science is trying to figure out about dark matter?
That's the hope. Yeah, that's definitely the hope. And, you know, dark matter is this thing that's been theorized, and everyone has been talking about it, but we've never actually, I don't want to call it the smoking gun of dark matter, but we've never actually said, here's some dark matter. Here you go. So they're hoping that they think that dark matter or even dark energy play huge roles in these cosmic voids. So as we're able to understand them better, hopefully we will be able to understand dark matter and dark energy better.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science and technology. Let's move into one of your favorite areas, Gemma, early human ancestors. And we're learning, so we know about the humans, right? That's
yeah.
us, the Homo sapiens. There's the Neanderthals. We hear a lot about them. There's a third crew out there
yeah.
that was living at the same time, maybe a little bit still living. What are we learning about the Denisovans?
Yeah, well, the Denisovans...
I said it wrong.
That's
okay. Close.
No worries. And you were indeed very close. But the Denisovans, the fascinating thing is we have only been aware of them for, you know, within the last 10 years. And what happened was researchers were digging up stuff in this cave, in Denisova Cave in Siberia in Russia. And they found this one tiny piece of bone and decided to test it. And it turned out that, hey, this belonged to the genus Homo, just like Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, but it wasn't either. So it's really only been in the past, you know, 8 or 9 years that we've been aware of them, and we're aware of them entirely through the DNA that they've been able to extract from one tiny fragment of finger bone and three teeth, and that's all we've found so far. There's probably more in the cave, but they haven't found it yet and definitively said it's Denisovan.
That's not a lot to go on when you look at what we've got to work with. What do you think are the big questions about who this group of people might have been?
Well, I think, you know, the big question is, what were they like? Because we've been able to understand genetically what they were, and in terms of how closely they were related to us, how closely they were related to Neanderthals, and also the fact that all three groups interbred with each other. And, you know, the Denisovans were also interbreeding with another mysterious archaic hominin group that we haven't identified yet, but we can see in their genes that there is a bit of archaic hominin hanky-panky going on way back when. So we can understand really genetically what they were like, how different and how similar they were to us, but we don't have any artifacts that we can say definitively were Denisovan. And in this cave, in this Denisova cave in Siberia, they found Denisovan bones, they found Neanderthal bones, they found human bones, and they found artifacts that they're really not sure which group of hominins they belong to.
Gemma, something I always wonder when I hear things about this, how much genetic differences there have to be before scientists will say, oh, this is one species or subspecies of human, this is another, sapiens, Neanderthal, Denisovans, as opposed to, you know, maybe they're all pretty much the same, there's just some, you know, limited variation.
Right, right, and that's, you know, something that, a question I get a lot, certainly. And basically, the classic delineation of a species is that it can't breed with another species and have a fully, you know, healthy reproductive offspring. So, yet we see that there were these examples of interbreeding within the hominins suggesting, well, maybe Denisovans and Neanderthals and our own species were really all one species. And that is one theory. However, there is enough difference genetically that people talk about, for example, you know, dogs and wolves. Technically, dogs are a subspecies of wolves, but they can still interbreed. And so maybe that the lines about being subspecies and species are really not that clearly delineated, and we need more ancient DNA to be able to say, okay, this is when the species split up.
It seems unusual that, you know, it's 2016 and we're just barely scratching the surface on what the Denisovans might have been like. How unusual is it that there really has only been this tiny little find in Siberia for these people?
Well, certainly in terms of, you know, early members of Homo sapiens, in terms of Neanderthals, we got a lot more stuff than we've got on the Denisovans. But at the same time, if you remember, you know, a couple hundred years ago, not even, there was a point where someone found the first Neanderthal skeleton. And for a while, that was all they had to go on. And they had a lot of different theories about it. But then they found more, and then they found more, and then they found artifacts. So we're really at the fabulous opening chapter of the Denisovan story. And we'll definitely find out more You just got to be patient because, you know, science just chugs along.
Before we leave the Denisovans behind, there is still a little Denisovan genetic material in some modern humans.
Yes, absolutely. It's a product of that interbreeding that happened back in the day. And you can see it in people in Southeast Asia and Oceania. And most intriguingly, it appears that, you know, the reason Tibetans can live without any trouble way high up, 13,000 feet and more above sea level, it appears to be because of a gene that they inherited from the Denisovans. So that's, you know, they live on among us one way or another.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, we'll have to keep in touch with you, Gemma, as more info about the Denisovans, or the Denisovans, as Rob likes to call them, comes out later on. Well, we're going to wrap up with a story about creeps and what we know about them, or at least what people think is creepy. Good timing right now, coming off Halloween. Gemma, what do people think about what a creep is?
Well, I have to say, I absolutely love this study. It is a study on the nature of creepiness, and they talk to about 1,300 people, most of them female, but males included, ages from 18 to 77. They ask them, hey, what is creepy to you? And the results, some of them are surprising, but the creepiest behavior, guys want to hazard a guess, what is considered the creepiest behavior?
We've looked at it, but I have already.
Okay. Well, then it's.
I can't remember.
Watches you before interacting.
So someone just like stares at you, and then comes up and talks to you.
Yeah. And another super creepy behavior is someone who touches you frequently during conversation.
Yeah, I'm with that creepy one. I find that creepy.
That's an interesting one because, you know, some how to build rapport advicey type sources say you should touch people to build
written
rapport.
Written by creeps.
Written by creep. The creep lobby is behind that one. And it looks like number three on that list of creepitude is steers conversation towards sex. That's creepy.
Yeah, it is. And, of course, asks to take your picture. And it didn't make the list, but I would personally add someone who Googles you before you meet and then, like, drops some obvious mentions of it. You know what I mean? Like, references that they would only know if they, like, we're spending a lot of time looking you up.
Rob and I are sorry we did that, Gemma, before we met you. Apologies.
Really,
that was not cool of us. And then there's creepy occupations, too, right?
Yes, and the first, the creepiest occupation is Central Time host.
No. Yeah, we get that a lot.
That's fair.
No, the creepiest occupation, no surprise to anyone, it is a clown.
Oh, the poor clowns. The poor clowns. They get so much bad rap. Gemma, thanks so much, as always, for joining us non-creepily.
Stay creepy, guys. Have a good one.
Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month for a look at some of the top science news.
Coming up after the news, some songs are so relaxing, you shouldn't drive when you're listening to them. We'll find out more.
This is Central Time. Stick around. Stephen Thompson from NPR Music is with us, coming up with some relaxing music. If you're feeling that anxiety, we'll hear more coming up after the news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up at 4, we'll look at gun control as an issue in Wisconsin elections.
First, election 2016 has been called a lot of things. Brutal, topsy-turvy, disgusting, anxiety-producing. Can't do anything about the election. It's just about over. But the stress of election night is still ahead. One way that can help relax, music.
According to researchers at Mind Lab International, certain songs can help us chill out when we're going through stress-producing situations. Top on their list, a song called Weightless. It's apparently so effective, it reduced participants' anxiety by 65%, and you probably shouldn't listen to it while you're driving.
Stephen Thompson from NPR Music joins us now to share his votes for music that can help reduce anxiety. He's a panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Stephen, welcome back.
That's great to be here.
Well, as a music listening guy, that's kind of your job. Do you buy this, that that listening to music can really significantly decrease our anxiety?
Oh my God, do I buy it? It's the only thing that has kept me from I don't even want to think about what it's kept me from doing.
What do you think it is about listening to mellow music or relaxing music that actually does seem to have a tangible effect on our psyche and the way we feel?
I mean, have you ever gone through, like, O'Hare Airport and you walk through, like, the New Age walkway where they've got, like, those little flickering neon lights and it's playing the ambient music and you feel, it makes you feel like a business traveler from the future to kind of strut by it. And the voice at the end of the moving walkway, I think they changed it and it's not quite as much like this anymore, but you'd walk up to the edge of the walkway and it would say, the moving walkway now. Please look down the moving walkway, and the sound of the voice sounded like it was saying, "All is well, all is well, all is well." And I think that music of a certain variety, whatever music calms you down, has that same effect of just like here. It's like I'm sitting on the porch with my friends, and you it sort of. Music has a way of placing you in a spot, and ideally, you know, comfort music places you in a spot that lowers your blood pressure just thinking about being there.
Well, let's check out this music from this Mind Lab International study. They found one song that seems to be the big winner, as we mentioned, "Weightless" by Marconi Union. Let's give a listen. Okay, so that's kind of what it does, I guess. Maybe it does other things too, Stephen. But does calmness, does anti-anxiety music, do you think it has to be that sort of slow, what would we call that, ponderous, mellow sort of sound?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, I listened to all 9 minutes. I think it's about a 9-minute long song. I listened to the whole thing.
We should play the whole thing without talking now. I don't think our bosses are listening.
Well, people are driving.
I could not tell you much about that song beyond the first couple minutes. You know, when I talk about transporting you to that relaxing place, that song transports you to the womb.
and the heartbeat. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and I think that's probably one reason why, like, scientific study determined that song really does relax you to an incredible degree. And I listen to a lot of ambient music at work. I work in a crowded office, and we don't have cubicle walls or anything like that. And so I will put on, I've got this mix actually on Spotify called Songs for Editing. And it's loud, it's louder than that. For me, it also needs to drown out exterior noise. But I listen to a lot of like this kind of swirling, enveloping, no vocals to distract you, you know, kind of sounds. I think they're very nice kind of for head clearing as much as relaxation.
And Stephen, you sent us some of your other go-to comfort music. I love that phrase, by the way, comfort music. And one of them is called, appropriately enough, Bread. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite songs of all time. It's from one of my favorite albums of all time. It's by a band called Clem Snide. And the album is called Your Favorite Music, which is also an appropriate name. And this particular song, it's just these details of like getting together with someone you love, and it conjures not only a place but the smell, and like the smell of baking bread. And like there's a line in the song, you smell like bread and now the pillow does too, and you're just transported to the most comfortable possible setting, and the song's just gorgeous.
And here's a listen.
'Cause you are the bread, and it's never work.
Nice mellow song there. It does have, I mean, bread, even the word bread just sort of evokes comfort and hearth and home and feelings of wellness.
Yeah, and his voice, the singer's a guy named Yves Barzelay, and his voice just hits this exact sweet spot for me. I've likened his singing voice to like Kermit the Frog, and you know how like Kermit the Frog is this source of like everything's okay. His voice just cuts through a lot of stuff for me, and it just very much sounds like a phone call from a friend.
We are having a phone call with our friend Stephen Thompson right now from NPR Music.
Good.
Thank you. They pay me to do this. We're talking about music that decreases anxiety, especially in this election anxiety season. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. We have Jason on the line in Oak Creek now. Jason, hi. Jason, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Barely. I think we're going to let that go and not getting a good connection with Jason. Jason wanted to say that the bass beat of that first song we played, Weightless, helps set our heart rate. And there's that doom, doom. I mean, is that, I didn't look closely at this study, but do you think there's something to that, Stephen? It's not just the associations. There's this physical thing where we can lock into it and attune ourselves to it.
Yeah, there's definitely a I mean, I'm no scientist, but there is definitely, there are chemical reactions to certain beats and you know, and sounds. And I think setting a heartbeat that is slower than your own is a good way to at least give you the perception that your own heart rate is slowing down.
And Stephen, you sent us another great one from your go-to comfort music list, and it's really, it's got the perfect mantra for 11:16. The song is called Easy Now, and it's by Joan Shelley. Let's hear a bit.
Easy now, it's almost over. Fever will run out now the nights are colder.
So the key phrase there being, it's almost over now.
It's written for election season, right?
I think everyone is repeating that now, Stephen. You want to share what your thoughts are on this one?
Yeah, she's just one of my favorite singers. She's a singer-songwriter from Kentucky. Joan Shelley, as you said, was her name. And when I was preparing for this segment and I was writing down, I just could not stop writing down songs that I go to, because I'm an anxious person. And so, my mind immediately takes me to these songs. Thinking about this song meant that I had to listen to this entire record on the way on the drive to work this morning. It's just such a beautiful, she has such a comforting voice. And I have used that Easy Now, It's Almost Over as a mantra throughout this election season and throughout any number of difficult points in my life that have cropped up since this record came out.
That's a good one. You know, talking about driving, that reminds me, I always pronounce, or I don't know how to pronounce the band's name, Sigur Rós from Iceland.
Sigur Rós
from Iceland. There's one of their albums that, listening to it, is definitely one of my calming things, and it is my Winter Dangerous Condition driving CD.
Because
I feel it expands my consciousness. Maybe it's their Icelandic roots or something, prepares me to deal with ice and snow or something like that. But, do you have anything like that, Stephen? The harsh condition music?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I actually do the exact same thing with that exact band.
No way.
Wow. I have a really, really powerful sense memory of driving actually back to Wisconsin from D.C. on very, very slippery roads, like kind of mountain roads in West Virginia, and having, I think the song's called Festival, this Sigur Rós song, and it's one that builds and builds and builds into this very, very, very stormy climax. And I remember, like, white knuckles on the wheel, my entire consciousness just enveloped by that song of just like, let every synapse fire, keep me on the road.
Yeah, I feel like my peripheral vision gets wider. Yeah,
your example is a perfect one.
I think we have to do a show on winter driving music,
I'm
thinking right now, but I guess it's just Sigur Rós songs all the way
through. Yeah, just that again and again.
Let's take another quick caller here. We've got Doug on the line in Reedsburg. Doug, hi.
Hi. One of my favorite bands that I ran across because I listen to some electronic music is Black Mill. And I think their song named Home is one of the best. Because it's electronic based, it has most of their songs don't have any lyrics to them. And I find that I am an auditory person, so I get distracted from auditory distractions really easily, especially people talking. So having music with no lyrics allows me to really focus. So when I'm doing math and stuff like that, because I'm a student, I love listening to it.
Stephen, are you familiar with Black Mill at all? Maybe the song Home?
No, I just wrote down on my notes, Black Mill, Home, so I can check it out, because I'm always listening for new music in that regard. I mean, in my editing playlist, I mean, I could just rattle off names of bands that I go to again and again. There's a woman named Juliana Barwick who makes these very, like, they sound like they're ringing out of church cathedrals, beautiful, beautiful kind of soundscapes. They're human voice, but not really lyrics. A band called Stars of the Lid, which makes a kind of kind of very, very cinematic, sweeping music, but that's still very enveloping and beautiful. I like I said, if you Google songs for editing Spotify, you should be able to find my playlist.
Nice.
That has a bunch of those bands on them.
We're talking with Stephen Thompson right now. He's an editor and reviewer at NPR Music and a panelist on Pop Culture Happy Hour. And Stephen's with us to talk about music to reduce anxiety as we head into the final day of election season.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What music do you listen to when you want to feel less anxious, when you want to chill out a bit? And have you been using it this election season? Is it working? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking with Stephen Thompson. He's an editor, reviewer at NPR Music, and a panelist on Pop Culture Happy Hour. And Stephen's here to share his music, his go-to music, when he wants to reduce anxiety, looking at this now in the closing hours of a nerve-wracking election season.
We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does music have this power for you? Can music reduce your anxiety? And what do you go to? What do you play in that hour of need? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers. We've got Quinn on the line in Milwaukee. Quinn, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your music?
I listen to just about everything, but I was curious as to why a lot of times I like to listen to like metal. So, you know, you have All That Remains, Disturbed, you know, old Metallica, Black Sabbath, things of that nature. And I wanted to ask Stephen why music of that nature can be just as calming as, you know, the music you guys were describing a few moments ago.
Quinn, thanks a lot. And I'm there too sometimes, Stephen. Queens of the Stone Age is sometimes something I want in a tense time. What do you think?
I agree completely, and I've had a lot of those experiences. My go-to is Andrew WK, who plays just this super duper duper overblown kind of party. Yeah, like hard rock party music. I think in general, first of all, the extremes I think are powerful. Extreme calm or just extreme just force of sound have this way of being very, very head clearing, and I have definitely like found myself just the like expenditure of energy of listening to extremely intense music actually, I think, can ultimately like leave you a little spent in a way that feels relaxing. It's almost like the feeling after a workout.
Right, I agree with that. I feel like it's almost a catharsis because someone else is screaming and letting it out while you're just sitting there a bundle of nerves, but by the time you're done, you've kind of done a little of that vicariously.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, you said this is not a scream metal track. You sent one called Bats in the Attic. This is from one of your favorite chill-out albums. What do you like about this one?
Okay, this is by a duo, a King Creosote and John Hopkins. And King Creosote is like the stage name of a Scottish singer-songwriter. And John Hopkins does amazing electronic music. He's another one. Track down the music of John Hopkins, and it serves a lot of the function we're talking about with this like loud ambient music. And they team up and make this beautiful record together called Diamond Mine that, among other things, will transport you to like the Scottish countryside. Huh. And you can just feel that location combined with this comforting, beautiful voice. That's my favorite album of a few years ago, and I go back to it again and again when I want to relax.
That's pretty. And you know, Stephen, I like, there's like that, it kind of leaves you hanging in that anticipation for the next thing. When I think of this kind of music, a Sigur Rós too, that's kind of what leads you in and maybe decreases that anxiety.
Yeah, and I think in the case of this particular record, John Hopkins uses a lot of found sound. Mm. And so you really, the album opens with this scene in a cafe, and you're just hearing the sounds of a Scottish cafe. Mm. And it really just places you somewhere else. And that's what so much of this is about.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Jackie joining us in Madison. Jackie, hi.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon. I got to find my telephone now. Where is it? Oh, here it is. I got it.
Hello.
All right, there you are. What did you want to share?
Music is very great for therapy. I write incidental music for film, and music can be therapy, like a new haircut. You know, you feel good for a haircut, you get a nice one. It's good therapy, right? Mm-hmm. And music can do both relaxing and motivating you to do things. I listen to motivational music when I'm doing work, which I'm doing right now. So if I listen to the ABBA or the Cars, something like that to keep me going, Ramones. But John Searle is the guy I like to listen to to relax.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for that. And Jackie saying music is therapeutic. This is kind of what we're getting at there. He likens it to a haircut, which I guess is kind of refreshing. But do
I
you see
know
it
about
as
that.
Is it therapy? I mean, I guess there are ways to use music in therapy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in general, like, music is very, very good for centering you and very much, very good for just, like, taking you to, transporting you to a comfortable place, but really, like, kind of just resetting is so important. And sometimes you don't necessarily need to relax so much as you need to reset and just kind of remember what your priorities are. And a piece of music that you know you love, that's the other thing. It's like this friend you can always count on without actually being a burden on anyone.
We are talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music about songs that can help reduce anxiety in an anxiety-producing election season. Here's one. Now, we're not going to identify it here because it's a bit of a spoiler. Here's one of the ones that you sent us. Let's give a listen now. All right, so unspoil it here, Stephen. What is that?
Okay, that is a very small piece of a 35-minute piece of music.
Famous classical composer, I assume. Experimental composer.
By a famous classical experimental composer by the name of Justin Bieber. That is the Justin Bieber song, You Smile, which is about a 3-minute song, stretched out, slowed down, and manipulated in some ways to a 35-minute dirge, and it turns him into takes his voice and turns him into kind of a celestial choir boy, and it sounds a little bit like Sigur Rós, and it is so enveloping completely. Unfortunately, you can't buy it. You can't find it on Spotify. You can still track it down, like, through SoundCloud and stuff like that, but it is taking something you think is one thing and turning it into another thing completely in a way that kind of makes you respect Justin Bieber more.
Right, it sounds like one of those trance, immersive sort of ambient tracks that we heard with Weightless. It seems like it's in that same school, but it's Justin Bieber. I love it. Do you know if that works with other Justin Bieber songs, Stephen? I assume you've tried it at home.
I have not spent a ton of time manipulating Justin Bieber songs, though I have heard, like, somebody took the Jurassic Park score, like about a 4-minute chunk of Jurassic Park score, and turned it into 45 minutes, and it kind of has that same effect. Part of it is you have the movements within a song become glacial in a way that just causes you to kind of just move along with the song as it very, very, very gently takes you through its changes. And the whole thing, it's a very relaxing experience.
Let's bring on another caller. Matt is with us in Spring Green. Matt, hi.
Hi. I was, what came to mind for me was, it's an aria opera written by Puccini. It's O Mio Babbino Caro.
Mm-hmm. I love that one.
Yeah, and I don't know, just recently I started hearing more of it. I've been kind of searching YouTube for different opera stars, and it was just struck me, and it's so calming to me.
Huh. Well, you guys are the opera people, not me, so you speak up now.
Oh, me and Stephen?
Yeah, or
Stephen,
at least you.
Could you sing a couple bars?
Nobody would be relaxed by that.
I could have maybe about 20 years ago, but yeah, not now. But that's a beautiful one. Yeah, it's exactly as Matt described it there. And I think that there is something to be said. I like to listen to classical when I'm stressed out because it has no strings to my present-day world. There's nothing that really hooks me into thinking of a relationship or a point of stress. It's just kind of an otherworldly experience. I like that.
Yeah, and a lot of classical music, I'm really fond of a composer named Arvo Pärt. His stuff, again, kind of fits that mood, that mold of, like, very, very enveloping music. Henrik Gorecki, Symphony No. 3 is another one I go back to frequently for that same purpose.
Matt, thanks a lot.
So, Stephen, what are you going to listen to? I assume we've stressed you out a lot. What are you going to listen to once we let you go?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I will probably go back and listen to the records I'm writing about this week, which aren't necessarily going to relax me, but I know I always have this playlist. I actually have a playlist on my iTunes called Couch Songs, and I will turn to it whenever I need to, which I'm sure I will a lot in the next 24 to 36 hours.
Nice. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
We're going to go out with a favorite of Stephen's. It's a track called Strawberry, some of his comfort music. Stephen Thompson is an editor and reviewer at NPR Music and a panelist on Pop Culture Happy Hour. Although he's living on the East Coast, he's originally from Wisconsin. And he joined us there to talk about what music to listen to if we want to reduce anxiety and relax.
All through the morning rain, I guess the sun doesn't shine.
In the Packers game yesterday at Lambeau, an unexpected visitor made an appearance on the field. Here's Phil Simms and Jim Nantz from CBS with the call.
By the way, there's been a squirrel on the field, and they continue away from the action trying to catch it. And the crowd has been paying as much attention to that little creature trying to find a home.
I mean, would you much rather watch a squirrel than Aaron Rodgers? I mean, you know.
Play was called off for a while during the third quarter as the field crew tried to catch the squirrel, who ultimately escaped, squeezed through a crack in the wall, and disappeared.
And for we Packer fans, the squirrel may have been the high point of the game, apart from a couple of interceptions by Ha-Ha Clinton Dix, since the Packers went on to lose to Indianapolis 31-26 in a tough loss to watch.
Simms and Nantz had some fun with the squirrel's appearance, though, at the Packers' expense, since the Packers' offense hadn't done well up to that point.
He's been trying to show the Packers the way to the end zone. He's been spending more time in it than the Green Bay side has.
Well, let's analyze it. That's good form. Springing. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Packers did perk up after the squirrel appearance. They did start scoring some, but not enough. So, I don't know, maybe they need to plan this squirrel interruption for earlier in the game next time.
So it's not quite a lucky squirrel, but maybe brings a bit of good luck?
Yeah, a bit of a positive boost. Better luck next time. And the squirrel, it seems like a happy ending. The squirrel got away without, you know, ending up in the middle of a play.
Right, we don't want to see the squirrel squashed on national
TV. No, definitely. And better luck next time for the Packers. This is Central Time.